wasn't clear when I called her back and said, okay, I think you might be right. I might have a problem. It wasn't clear when she dropped me off at that meeting. But I was in that meeting for about 30 minutes. And they called on me, which was deeply annoying to me. I didn't want to be seen. They said, would you like to share? The standard protocol in an AA meeting is to say, hi, my name is Meg and I'm an alcoholic. But I couldn't say that. It was my first meeting. So I just said, hi, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't even know if I should be here. And then I start rambling and I say something to the effect of, I don't know what I said before this, but here's the moment. I said, I don't even know if I should be here because I haven't lost my job. And this woman behind me goes, yet. And I've never been to jail. And she says, yet. And everything in my life is fine and nothing's really broken down. And she says, yet. And I'm so pissed, Gary. Like, I want to turn around and be like, what is your problem? You know what I mean? Like, I'm irate. I'm like, listen, lady. That was my unlock moment. Because she kept saying it. I kept being annoyed. And then there was like a surrender. She was absolutely right. And I was never unclear after that. I was in pain. I was in turmoil. I was in struggle. I was in great moments of difficulty. But I was never unclear that I was exactly right where I needed to be and that there was freedom coming my way, liberation coming my way, which is different than freedom. And that was a moment. And I can remember her voice and her face and that moment with absolute clarity. And nothing has ever been the same since.
My name's Dr. Gary Crotaz, and I'm a coach, podcaster, and award-winning author of The Idea Mindset, a book about how to figure out what you want and how to get it. The unlock moment is that flash of remarkable clarity when you suddenly know the right path ahead. When I'm in conversation with my coaching clients, these are the breakthroughs that are so profound that they remember vividly where they were, who they were with, what they were thinking when their unlock moment happened. In this podcast, I'll be meeting and learning about people who have accomplished great things or brought about significant change in their life. And you'll be meeting them with me. We'll be finding out what inspired them, how they got through the hard times, and what they learned along the way that they can share with you. Thank you for joining me on this podcast to hear all about another Unlock Moment. Hello, dear listener, and welcome to another episode of the Unlock Moment podcast. Over the past couple of years, I've been privileged to have many inspirational business leaders on the podcast, and today I'm delighted to welcome another. As owner and CEO of a major multinational corporation, Megan Gluth-Bohan is a picture of success, but the path there was not easy, and her struggles have taught her the critical importance of compassion, empathy, and resilience in leadership. No matter who or where you are, Megan is living proof that now is always the best time to take the first step forward. Megan leads Catalent Solutions, a major US-based chemical distributor that makes raw materials for a huge range of industries and is one of the largest certified women-owned suppliers in North America. Megan was one of five owners honored as the Business Journal's Middle Market Fast 50 Leaders of 2023, and she's also a winner of the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year 2023. But today, we're talking about Megan's journey that made her the leader she is today. My regular listeners will know that I'm deeply curious about people, and in particular, those unlock moments of remarkable clarity in your life or career that stick with you for decades and give you foundation and purpose. I'm fascinated to hear about a singular act of kindness that changed Megan's life forever. Megan Gluth-Bohan, it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the Unlock Moment.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm just delighted to be here with you.
Oh, I'm delighted that we could make this all happen. So today you're a celebrated leader in the demanding chemicals industry. But if we really wanted to understand the person you are today, where would we need to start in your story?
I think that my story has a lot of starts. And I think like most of our lives, I think some days can have a lot of starts. But I suppose if you were to understand me holistically, you would start in my childhood, in the same way you would start with anyone else.
Tell me more.
I was born and raised in a small town in the middle of the United States, in a very interesting part of the country, which is largely agricultural. Mm-hmm. Most of the people in my community lived in some way off a dependence on the land and on the seasons and in a very agricultural way. And it was a really, really great place to grow up. The community was small, very small. And there's some things about that obviously have a downside as well. But in that also, in my story, it was a community where there were kind of different worlds of where people lived. And the world that I grew up in was one of poverty, and there's trauma in that story, and there's a difficulty and a striving that sometimes wasn't met with success.
How old were you when you first, what were your first memories of that time?
You know, it's interesting. So I'm the oldest of five children, but my brother and I are 13 months apart. And then after each of our parents remarried, actually, they each had additional children. And so he and I are 13 months apart. And my brother has this vivid sense of memory going back very, very early. I do not. I think my earliest memories are probably, somewhere 4 or 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I remember being in this, there's a strong sense of freedom, frankly. You live a lot outside. There's a lot of, like I said, swinging from ropes and barns and things like that. There's a lot of that kind of memory happening and a lot of sort of necessity breeding invention, right? We used to make believe a lot and play outside. And so I have really, really fond memories of being imaginative and being sort of outside and left up to my own devices, which has certainly served me in my business these days. But I would say that I also had at that time too, just an awareness of sort of the sadness around me. And I'm not just talking about within my family. I really was aware of a lot of the struggle. I think you find that a lot in agricultural communities and people who rely on farming. And there are definitely some haves, but there's a lot more have-nots. And I was certainly well aware of sort of the energy of that growing up.
Yeah. And how did that impact you as you were growing up and becoming an adolescent?
You know, initially, I think like all children, I think I didn't know much about how that environment affected me as a person. I was more rooted in the mood of the members of my household and the sense of, whether everyone was okay at home. But I then very quickly started to pick up on this sense of sort of lack and of us not having what we needed, and of hunger, of housing insecurity, of sort of a lot of the trauma that goes along with that, a lot of the shame, the really profound shame that goes along with that. I don't know how young I was when I first started to sort of try and cover up the fact that we didn't have money, or we couldn't do things, or I couldn't take a sack lunch to school. At that time, I was on the free and reduced school lunch program in the United States that really does serve children in poverty. And I remember feeling a lot of shame about that. And so that started to sort of move in me as a sense of just what do I do with this? This is big. This is bigger than me. This is beyond my control. And then I started to become more aware of how that affected the adults around me and the ways they coped with that. And I had this growing sense of unease. And even now when I tell you about it, I can feel that unease in my body. I can feel that sense of lack, and I can feel that sense of insecurity, deep, deep insecurity, that once it's inside your body, I'm not sure your body differentiates between financial insecurity or just insecurity in general. But it caused me to have a deeply unsettled feeling for a very good portion of my life.
I've had a few people who've come on the podcast and told stories of challenge in their upbringing. Everybody's unique and different, but there's commonalities in those stories. And there's something about kind of a grit that is born in people through that kind of upbringing, that kind of environment. I also sometimes see this sense of independence that comes from that. And you're smiling as I say that. What comes up for you when I say that?
It's twofold. You're absolutely right. So I sense that too. Frankly, I talk to a lot of people and I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, and I, like you, I mean, part of the reason I think that you and I are going to enjoy this conversation and certainly enjoy the conversation we had prior is that we're both deeply curious people. And when you are, you learn things about people. And you're right, there's a commonality. There's a sense of independence. There's a sense of, I want to create my own freedom. I don't have a lot. And so I have to develop these skills of grit, and I have to develop different ways to get to the same place that other people get easier, right? And so you're right, it does develop a sense of grit and all of that independence. The flip side of that coin is the sort of, I'm not going to call it the darker side or the shadow side, but it is the more tender side of that, which is to say that when you're marinating sort of in that soup of insecurity that I'm talking about, sometimes that front of independence is a little bit false and it's a little bit protective. And we do that because underneath that, we are ashamed, like I said, or we're hurting, or we feel like we don't fit in, or we feel like there are barriers to entry for us. I felt a lot as a child like I was not worthy, like there was something fundamentally wrong with me. And now as an adult, I can look back and say that's hogwash. It's not possible to say that poverty affecting a child has anything to do with their worthiness, but I still have to untangle that knot as an adult. I have to be really conscious of that now. And so that's what I mean by this shadow side of this independence. Yes, I had great gifts coming from that, this grit, this independence, this drive. I also need to make sure that the motivation and that the energy behind that isn't one of protecting myself from that fear of being unworthy or that fear of scarcity.
Did it impact your education itself? Did you struggle at school? Did you do okay at school? How was that?
Certainly in grade school and middle school and high school. I'm very careful on these podcasts. I try not to speak about people who are not here. Mm-hmm. And so I want to be cautious, but I do want to say that one of the characteristics sometimes of being in these situations is that your home life isn't great. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember feeling really supported in my education. And there was a lot of reasons for that. I often felt like sort of the lost child a little bit in that regard. And so I made it through school in sort of, I guess, primary, you know, K through 12. All right. I did okay. When I didn't understand things or when I struggled with things, I didn't have the same resource bench, frankly, that a lot of other people had in order to go get what they needed to do better. But I did all right. The problem for me started in college. I can see this, you know, starting before college, but obviously college is, you know, here you're left out on your own now. You're an adult, allegedly, and you're out and you're going to handle this. And I realize now, didn't know then, I was a really traumatized, deeply wounded, deeply hurting young woman who had no coping skills and no one was seeing me. And I had no way to deal with that. And I went into college and I just tore the lid off of my life in that time. I started drinking really heavily, using other substances, hanging out with people that did not bring forth like the best possibilities for my future, and engaging in things that I look back now and I used to look at them with such a regret and a guilt and a shame. And now I just look back on that with a sadness, like a sadness for that woman who was. It ended up resulting in me being kicked out of college. Really quite simply because I had a priority for partying and not for academics. Mm. And that causes consequences, very real consequences for which I suffered. And it took me a while I needed to go to a community college or junior college, whatever you want to call it, get some grades back up on the board and prove to a university that I could be a worthy student. And I did finally get accepted to a four-year, you know, institution. 7 years it took me to get a Bachelor of Arts degree, but I did. But again, that, you know, that season of my life represents a time where some of the consequences, the way that I was coping or not coping, sort of made manifest in my life.
And at that moment of being kicked out of college, with all of those things going on that sort of triggered that outcome, did you have a realization then, really, that things needed to change, or was that not yet fully formed in your thinking?
Not at all. you know, it's really, I think a realization of things needing to change goes through a process for most of us. And certainly for me and that, Gary, my season of life there was, I'm going to blame other people. This is somebody else's fault. I'm going to manipulate my way out of this. I'm going to tell myself a story about how this went, how it wasn't my fault. So certainly no internal self-awareness about my responsibility in that and my agency and my power, none whatsoever.
And talk to me about funding this journey. I mean, you know, as you start to get into college, university, that's an expensive thing to do. How was that for you?
Well, in my bachelor's degree, I was able to apply for government aid. And because I was a low-income family, I got a lot of it. And a lot of, you know, private aid from the schools and institutions. The trouble came for me. I reached the end of this bachelor's degree and I had a degree in history, which was lovely because it was something I loved studying. But really, I didn't have a lot of career paths forward. So I took the LSAT, which is the law school, the initial law school entrance or competency exam. And I ended up getting accepted to law school. And I thought that's what I'll do. Because ultimately, Gary, what I wanted to do was make money, earn a living. And, you know, this seemed like the next indicated thing. And a few weeks before law school was going to start, they came to me and said that I didn't have a financial aid package that was adequate to support the education there. I had borrowed at the limit of what I could get from the government, and the only thing available to me left was private loans. I want you to imagine this adult who's been kicked out of college before for partying, did not clean up her act. I mean, again, I was doing okay. I was doing the things, but it's not like I had this robust credit score and I was going to be, you know, applying for loans. And so a friend of mine's father co-signed on my student loans for law school.
Wow.
And it is only now, as a woman, you know, much older than I was then, looking back on this now, that I realize really, really the enormity of that gift, of what he did, just the simple act of co-signing. First of all, I wouldn't have co-signed for me if me 20 years ago walked into this room right now and said, co-sign on, you know, six figures of loans for law school. Absolutely not. So the enormity of the risk he was taking on me, the enormity of the potential he must have seen that I couldn't. And then the enormity of just what that set off and set in motion in my life. I mean, I'll just be grateful that's not enough of a word for what he did for me.
It's remarkable. Did he know you well? You know, why did he co-sign for you, do you think?
I think it was twofold. Yes, he knew me, I say well enough. I mean, his daughter was a dear friend of mine. And so obviously, you know, most parents know the friends of their kids, but he probably had to also know that I wasn't maybe the most responsible individual on earth. You know, like there's some, and again, I talk about this season of my life now without any shame because it is what it is, you know, and I have learned from it. But I think that it was also a little bit about him. You know, his background and his life was such that he didn't have the easiest upbringing either. And I think there is a saying, and it's modified throughout different faith traditions and things like that, but the saying that deep calls to deep. And sometimes I think that the deepest parts of ourselves call to the deepest similar parts of other people. And I think that's what happened with him and I. And so I think what he did was as much about him as it was about me. And I admire the way that he responded to that with action.
What an incredible gift. And I can hear in you now, you know, years and years on, how meaningful that was as a moment in your life.
Yeah, deeply, deeply. And I won't, unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. And this is, you know, a lesson, like you have to tell people when you think of them, how they've changed your lives. I wrote them a note, he and his wife, when I paid those loans back and thanked them for that. But it wasn't enough. I wish I would have sat and said, tell me why you did that. You know, the one thing he did tell me to do was to make sure that I did that for someone else. That when I was ever, he said, when you have the opportunity and when you are in the position to do this, I want you to do it for other people. And I have, and I will continue to, but the one thing that was really neat about that is that he said, when you are,
yeah.
And he knew I would be there.
It's amazing. And people listening to this can't see you, but I can I can see you, and I can just tell the listeners how lit up you are by telling that story and the impact that person's had on your life. It's an incredible story. So what happened after that?
So I went to law school, and I was, you know, law school's tough. There's no way around that. That's an incredibly demanding feat of your time. And so I was a full-time law student. And then when the rules allowed, I got a part-time job. You know, initially you're not supposed to work when you're in law school. And midway towards the latter end of my first year of law school, I met a wonderful woman, and we fell madly in love. And she was just an absolute light in the world, just an absolute light. But midway through my second year of law school, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And our lives were entirely upended by this illness because it's an aggressive cancer. It's not an ideal cancer to have. And so fighting that became, for both of us, full-time, more than full-time work. And so I was a full-time law student. I had a job, and I had a what turned out to be a terminally ill cancer patient at home that I was taking care of. And this began a season of my life that even now, as I sit later and look back, I just put my head down and dug my shoulders forward and did the work. Somehow, in the midst of all of this, I graduated from law school. Somehow, I took and passed a bar exam, which is not an easy feat. But I don't remember an hour of that bar exam. I mean, I simply just did what I had to do to survive and to get through. And I want to be really clear. I did that standing on the shoulders of so many people that came around and supported and just, you know, dropped off meals and helped. But at the end of the day, everyone goes home and there you are standing, holding some of the most difficult moments of your life emotionally and physically and energetically and doing that really, frankly, alone. And on Christmas Eve, the year after I was sworn into the bar and had started working as an attorney, she passed away at home.
I'm sorry.
And for me, that was all the oxygen left the room. You know, it was absolutely sort of the unwinding of everything, because it's not that I was surprised by her death. It's not that I didn't know, but a huge component of how I kept busy and a huge component of how I avoided what was going on. Like all of that gyration within, we have this to do and this doctor appointment, it all died. It all just went. And there I sat in that stillness and in that grief was in that room as well. Right. And, one has a choice of what to do with that. And it was just overwhelming. It was absolutely overwhelming for me. Mm-hmm.
And I hear that aloneness. I mean, it's a tragic story. And I can't imagine what it would have felt like to go through what you went through. And I just hear that thread in your story about the experiences that have made you who you are today. And I know everyone listening is going to be hung on your every word in this story too. So what happened after that time?
I would love to tell you that I handled that well, but I didn't. And that's such an important part of the story for anybody listening. And it's a part I tell frequently. I fell deeper and deeper into all of my tools of avoidance. And so if you were to look at me on the outside, I think you'd probably see a person that was going through the motions, going to work, you know, all of that. And I did. Listen, I wasn't breaking laws. I was the very definition, Gary, of a functional alcoholic, you know, except that what wasn't functioning was me internally. I could not come near. That grief followed me everywhere. And the more time passed, the larger and larger and larger its presence became in my life. It's just looming over me at all times. And I just couldn't touch it. I couldn't be with it. I couldn't stand it. And so I was drinking to avoid and to just leave the situation and to make it somewhat bearable, to go to sleep, to move in the world, to just do anything. And I think I tell that story because I think a lot of people have this thought about addiction and about substance abuse is it's something we choose to do and it's thing that that we do and we fall into a bad habit. Listen, Gary, it wasn't like that. What I was choosing inadvertently was to avoid grief. I needed out of that. I didn't have any tools. I didn't have any skills. I didn't have any people. I didn't know what to do. And what I was choosing was living. And I know that sounds strange to say I was living by drinking, but I need you to understand that that numbness was a key part of my survival. And I leaned really heavily into that. Mm-hmm. And again, not proud of it, but also not ashamed anymore either.
It's real. It's real. And one of the things that when I think, I feel like I'm doing something right with this podcast is when people tell stories that other people might be experiencing and are not telling. And mm-hmm. I want people to hear, this is what it really feels like to be in that space that you were in. And I can't tell you how it makes me feel that you're prepared to come on and talk so openly about that journey, because I know how much it will mean to people that are listening who will go, that makes sense to me. That connects with me. I feel like that. I felt like that. And who was around you at that time? If anyone, who was supporting you?
I had a lot of people around me, but I was all alone. I think one of the defining features of addiction is that we isolate. And I think there were definitely well-meaning people around me who would have wanted to reach through that noise, but I wouldn't have listened to them. They couldn't have gotten in. And so there, everyone was around, but no one was there, if that makes sense. And the people that I did choose to surround myself were people who I could drink openly with and around and in front of. Part of that's on me too. I surrounded myself with people that maybe weren't there necessarily for the uplift of my character and well-being. But it was a very lonely time, Gary. Years of loneliness, self-inflicted and otherwise.
There's a phrase I sometimes talk about in the context of the unlock moment, which is being alone with others. And actually often when I talk about it, and maybe we'll see this in the story that comes through here too, is that it's a positive aloneness because it's an aloneness of accountability. And it's a, only I can change the situation. And there are other people who are there to support me, can support me, will support me, but it's only me. But I wrote down this phrase that you said, everyone was around, but no one was there. And I think that's an incredible articulation. It makes sense to me when you say that, more what it would have felt like to be in that place.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to be really clear that I think I had an experience that, you talk about talking about things that other people are in. So I had a view in my head of what an alcoholic was and what an addicted person was and things like that. So I was looking in my life, as long as every day I still had a job and I wasn't in jail and that everything was fine. And in fact, I was a really high performer. And so I got a lot of miles off those tires for myself. And when you do that, then you're looking outward. And looking outward, as long as things look fine on the outside, then maybe it doesn't call for this internal reflection. And the question you're asking, I think, is more of what was going on inside. Mm-hmm. I can only tell that story in the context of what it felt like to need to change, because I was numb to a lot of what it felt like before I felt that way. I've spoken, obviously, about sort of this looming beast of grief. And every day, by the way, the grief grows. Every day, that beast gets stronger and stronger. And the room that you're in with that, whatever it is that you're avoiding, the longer you're in a room with that, the bigger it gets and the smaller the room gets. And you sort of stay the same size. There's just less room for you. So it becomes very claustrophobic. And I tell it that way because I want listeners to feel uncomfortable, because it is uncomfortable. There is no moment of awakening within addiction or any other thing that you need to change in yourself until you are deeply, deeply, deeply uncomfortable. And that for me is what happened. I got claustrophobic and uncomfortable. And I had so many moments, ordinary moments, where I would start to wake up and think, this is not who I am. Hope for me looked an awful lot like these little budding offshoots of dreams that I had for really simple, ordinary things. I always tell the story that I always wanted to make it to the farmer's market and be a farmer's market person. But I was always too hungover to get to the farmer's market. And so I never went to the farmer's market. So one of my moments was thinking, oh my gosh, there's a delta, there's a discrepancy between this longing in me and what I'm capable of doing. That's really solo work, Gary. And it's not even necessarily lonely. It's solo work. It is a journey you take by yourself. I don't know any way for any person to have a companion inside there. And it certainly wasn't for me. That pump is priming. And then, now I'm living out on the West Coast. That's a story in and of itself. But, you know, I moved away from where my first wife and I lived, and I'm living on the West Coast. And a few years have passed, and I meet someone else, and she's incredible. She says to me, I really like you, but I think you have an alcohol problem, and I'm not interested in that in my life. Well, now all of a sudden I have somebody standing in that room with me. So now we're really uncomfortable. Okay. She didn't come in to fix it. She didn't come in to clean it. She just came and said what was right for her. But now she knows about my room. She knows about this space. And so now it's me and the grief and the trauma and the this and the that and her in this room, and it's shrinking. So what did I do? I told her to get out because I can't handle anyone else in the space. So she leaves. And the loneliness at that point is different than the loneliness prior to her coming into that room, because now I miss her. And I'm starting to realize that the things I'm making space for in that room suck compared to her. And so the story goes that I had this period of, you know, wrestling a little bit and definitely told her. She didn't know what she was talking about and whatnot. But ultimately, a few days after that, I called her and she drove me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a drink since. And that's pretty incredible for me and for where I was. And that was the beginning of the end of my loneliness, because then I started to be in rooms with people where I told the truth and I showed up and said who I was. And I said things to them like, you know, I'm alone in this room. It's getting really claustrophobic and it's really hard in here. And I'd look around the room and everybody would be nodding their heads and they knew. And that's the day the loneliness disappeared.
And that's my alone with others in the positive way. It's still you. It's still just
right.
You sitting on your chair in that group. What was different that you felt now was a time you could change and stop drinking?
I was seen. You know, even when you're seen for your mistake, for your darkest moment, for your big ugly, whatever that is for you, you're still being seen. That's what made it different, being truly seen. I think, just so you know, the end of the story, I married her. actually, today is our anniversary. We've been together for 13 years.
Amazing.
I think that if she were sitting here right now, she'd tell you she saw so many positive things about me, but it was the seeing of the thing, of my big ugly, that made me feel really, truly seen.
And did it feel like a choice to go down one path or down the other path?
Yes, but not in the traditional sense where you're standing at a fork in the road and you have to choose right and left. I didn't feel it that way. For me, it felt like I was being thrust forward. See, I had this person that I really loved come into this tiny, tiny room, and then she left. And once again, I'm at an experience in my life where all the air is getting sucked out of the room, and I'm standing here alone in this room, in this crowded place with the demons large in size. And I couldn't go back in. I couldn't go back in. And I don't know if that's a choice. I just was at a place where the pain of going back into what I knew and the pain of trying to cram myself back into that room, it became more impossible than the unknown pain of going forward. And there's a saying that you cannot end any pain with pleasure. There is no pleasurable way out of pain. And I'm going to tell you that's absolutely true, but I spent a long time looking for that, right? And so did it feel like a choice? Like, no, it felt more like an imperative. But it was also terrifying. And it became affirmative. I want you to know though, Gary, that the things that became affirmative started off as really, really little things. I didn't sit there and think at any moment, like, today's the day I changed my life. And I just crawl into the full lotus position and start thinking about that. Like, it was really quite simply like, okay, today I'm going to get up at 6 a.m. and I'm going for a walk. And all I'm going to do is this walk. And then I'm going to go to a meeting. And then I'm going to go to work. And it was just very like little teeny tiny ordinary choices. That's how it started.
There's a thing that I sometimes observe in people when they're describing unlock moments. And I think of, I often talk about sort of a true unlock moment is these moments of remarkable clarity. And you just remember right back in that moment, many years ahead in the future, where you were, who you were with, what you were thinking. And one of the characteristics is that before that moment, there was something that was fog that was not clear, that you were stuck in this space. And then after the moment, it was suddenly clear, crystal clear, and never again foggy. There are times in life sometimes when we go, I think I figured it out. And then a day later you go, no, it's still complicated, it's still confusing. But in a true unlock moment, it's clear. And then you go, it was never unclear again. Mm-hmm. In this moment, when you decided that something needed to change, was going to change, and you stopped drinking and you never drank again. Do you recognize, does that feel like that for you, that sense of it was clear? I mean, it was easy, but it was clear.
Yes. I wasn't clear when I called her back and said, okay, I think you might be right. I might have a problem. It wasn't clear when she dropped me off at that meeting. But I was in that meeting for about 30 minutes and they called on me, which was deeply annoying to me. I didn't want to be seen. and they said, would you like to share? The standard protocol in an AA meeting is to say, hi, my name is Meg and I'm an alcoholic. But I couldn't say that. It was my first meeting. So I just said, hi, I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't even know if I should be here. And then I start rambling and I say something to the effect of, I don't know what I said before this, but here's the moment. I said, I don't even know if I should be here because I haven't lost my job. And this woman behind me goes, yet. And I've never been to jail. And she says, yet. And everything in my life is fine and nothing's really broken down. And she says, yet. And I'm so pissed, Gary. Like, I want to turn around and be like, what is your problem? You know what I mean? Like, I'm irate. I'm like, listen, lady. That was my unlock moment. Because she kept saying it. I kept being annoyed. And then there was like a surrender. She was absolutely right. And I was never unclear after that. I was in pain. I was in turmoil. I was in struggle. I was in great moments of difficulty. But I was never unclear that I was exactly right where I needed to be. And that there was freedom coming my way. Liberation coming my way, which is different than freedom. And that was a moment. And I can remember her voice and her face and that moment with absolute clarity. And nothing has ever been the same since.
There's something you said, which is quite remarkable. I recorded about 130 episodes of the podcast and last week recorded an episode, which is a sequel to an episode with Michael Leibrand, who's a world-leading strengths coach. And the sequel was an hour and 45 minute, very flowing conversation. We talked about it just before recording today. And a word she'd used that's never been used in 130 episodes of the podcast is that really an unlocked moment feels like surrender.
Yeah.
And then you've just used exactly the same word. Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. Tell me more about that moment of surrender.
At the moment, it felt like an absolute unclenching, a letting go. In fact, I bet if you saw me and filmed me in that moment, you'd probably see my whole body just fold into that chair. Do you know what I mean? Just this absolute and complete letting down. What I recognize that moment for now is the moment that I loosened my hands on this steering wheel and gave myself and my life over to something bigger than me. And for as long as I live, I won't be able to define that for you. And I say that really intentionally because I'm not even ever going to try. I just know when I know. And I know that there is this presence that holds the other half of the rope of my life, so to speak. And I do better in this world when I let that drive and when I just succumb and surrender to the fact that it has its power and I am okay to be entirely dependent on that and surrendered to it. When we do that, and when I did that, everything in the universe conspires to make that okay. So you spend all of your life thinking if I don't keep hold of this and I don't remain in control, then things are going to go wrong. But the truth is that the minute I surrendered, the entire universe lined up. I could tell you things that would blow your mind, Gary, of what lined up in my life and what conspired to this, the reason I'm sitting here today. It's almost unbelievable. But it all goes back to that moment of absolute and total surrender.
You're an incredible storyteller. When I started this podcast, I started it because I was curious about people, but I didn't realize how much. And I was interested in unlocked moments because I'd had a few along my journey, but I didn't really understand them in a way that I understand them now, and I'm still exploring. And something that has become clearer to me in the last, not very long, probably 3 months or so, some of the conversations I've had with people, is a fundamental truth that I'm finding, that when you talk to people about the time they chose to tell you about where to start in their story, and you talked about your childhood story, and then where they choose to tell you about their unlocked moment, and here, one that you're describing with huge profoundness is that moment of surrender with that woman behind you saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. The third part of it is, what does that tell you about who you are today in life, in work, in leadership? And it's like a different lens from the ones we normally use, where we go, this is my job, or this is my job title, or this is my role, or this is my balance of things that I do in work and life. These are my accolades. These are my achievements. That's not what I'm curious about. I'm curious about who are you today because those stories that you've told.
I want to be really intentional in the way I answer that. Who I am today is a woman in progress. And that will be who I am when you talk to me and I'm 90. So in that moment, I have this surrender. I have this time where I have to realize like all my bullshit isn't working. You know what I mean? And when I use that word, I use it really kind of intentionally, and that encapsulates all the ways I feel about the world and the ideas I have and the strengths I have and all that. It's just not working. Even today, I am a person. I run a multi-million dollar business across many, many continents. I am a person that gets still and quiet every day and actively sometimes has a visual imagery of handing all of this over to this unseen force and saying, if I give this up out of my hands, I know that the universe is going to conspire to make something amazing happen here. That happens with the way that I parent my children. That happens with the way I live my marriage. That happens with the way that I run my business. It happens with the way that I struggle with myself. Because newsflash, like I didn't get sober and then all my life's problems went away and I'm just this magically great person. It isn't like that. But I am a person who returns again and again and again to the principle of having to just let go and to use intuition. And currently I'm in a season in my life of not gaslighting myself when that intuition tells me what's right and what's wrong. I still have my lawyer brain. I still have my CEO and founder or owner brain. I still have all of those responsibilities and all those things. It's very easy for me to say, you can't just surrender this. You can't just be intuitive about this. You have logic and data and you could be wrong and this doesn't make any sense. And on paper, how would you ever explain this to anyone? And I'm learning. I'm at a season in my life where I am learning to say, this doesn't have to make sense to the outside world. I just know. And so I think that that woman who's sitting there listening to Yet and she surrenders, I think that she's here now and she still surrenders. And now the challenge for her is a little bit different. Don't let your mind come in. Don't let all of this, you know, meddling in your own goodness come in. And I think when I'm 90 years old, it'll look a little different how I do that. But I think I will always orient back to being somebody who is becoming surrendered and who is letting go and who is looking for the sort of the release of my will, if I can.
And as a leader of a business and with people in your charge and people in your world, do you sometimes see people coming through who are going through their own challenges, different but familiar to you?
All the time. I can't not see it. My role in life now, or my challenge, is to remember what my role is in people's lives. And just because I see it doesn't mean that I get to be involved in it. I'm utilizing my voice now and trying to put my voice out into the public space to say, this is where I've been, this is what happened, because if there's somebody that's for me, if there's somebody that needs to hear what happened and there's somebody who needs to be uplifted by this, I want to reach them. But I can't hit anybody over the head with it. But yeah, I see it all the time. I just have to remember where I end and they begin, right? Because I wouldn't have listened to you, Gary, before I was ready, you know?
And that's the thing. It's like, it's everyone's time at the right time. And you can't accelerate that. Mm-mm. And you can't do it for them. And
no.
You can't even stand next to them and make it easy without them taking the step to do it themselves. Do you have a sense of wanting to build a legacy?
Yes, I do. But I think my view of legacy is maybe a little bit different. I'm not too impressed with myself, Gary. And I don't mean to say that I don't have self-esteem and I don't have, like, I do. I really like myself and I love myself and I care for myself. But I'm actually not super impressed. And sometimes I sort of wonder, like, what's the big deal? You know what I mean? Like, I guess I look at my life and I look at where I've arrived and I go, oh, I guess this is actually really remarkable. This is really cool. But I don't think that I necessarily feel that all the time. Not in a negative way. I just don't know. So when I think about legacy, I think about what's my gift? What am I here for? Why did I come to this planet in this time and place in history? And what are all these experiences leading up to? What am I supposed to do? And I feel really, really strongly that people who work for me and people who work with me will tell you that I'm a very authentic person and pretty much what you see is what you're going to get. And I'm a pretty pragmatic leader and I don't do things with a lot of fluff and circumstance. And so this authenticity, this approachability, this realness, I think is part of the gift. And so is all this garbage I've been through. It's also part of the gift. So then I look at that and I think, well, if the desire to just tell you the truth about the good, bad, and the ugly of me and the willingness to do that and all of this garbage, if those are here at the same time, then I think the call, the purpose is to say it and to put it out there. And again, to what I was saying earlier, like if there's one person who hears this and says, oh my gosh, she's describing the tiny, tiny room I'm in with all of these demons and it is getting dark in here. If that person hears it and knows they're not alone and it gives them something to get out of that room, like That's my legacy, Gary. Because when that person gets out of that room, I can't begin to tell you it. Like, I tear up. The number of people whose lives are changed when you change and when you become whole and healed, like the ripple effect across the entire world is it brings me to tears. Like it's amazing. So I think if I can help people get there and do that and access their own liberation, then I'm going to be part of something that's so big, you know, and I will have done my part in that. And they don't have to know me and I don't have to know them. I think that's my legacy on this earth. And I'm going to do it to the best of my ability.
And I think we can hear that too. I can't tell you, I mean, you're an incredible storyteller and your openness and vulnerability in telling that story is something else. And I've hugely appreciated that. How can people get in touch with you, find out more about you, and find out more about the work you do?
I have a website, www.megangluthbohan.com. It's my name, all one word, and I'm sure you'll have that spelled out in your show notes. That's the best way to get a hold of me. I'm not super good at, like, you know, LinkedIn Messenger and things like that. Start there. I really do seek to connect with people. I don't need you to be a CEO of another company to reach out and connect with me. Who you are as a person is enough for me, and it should be enough for you. And but that's probably the quickest and most direct way.
Amazing. The unlock moment is that flash of remarkable clarity when you suddenly know the right path ahead. For multinational CEO Megan Gluth-Bohan, it was a moment of kindness by her friend's father that changed her life forever and inspired her to commit to passing that kindness on. Megan, I can't even tell you, it's been such a great pleasure to have you on telling your story. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Unlock Moment.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
If you've enjoyed this conversation about overcoming personal challenges to find happiness and unlock authentic leadership, then check out episode 57 with the inspirational Mike Ott. And if you resonated with how Megan had to listen to the voices of others to make the change in her life, check out episode 104 with recovered addict and NBA mindfulness coach George Mumford, and episode 18 with emotional eating coach Chris Tibbetts. Bookmark these episodes for later. This has been The Unlock Moment, a podcast with me, Dr. Gary Crotez. Thank you for listening in. You can find out more about how to figure out what you want and how to get it in my book, The Idea Mindset. Find me on Instagram at Dr. Gary Crotez and subscribe to this podcast to get notified about future episodes. Most listeners to this podcast on Apple and Spotify haven't yet hit the follow button. If there's one thing you can do right now to help me out, then please click the follow button. The more followers I have, the better guests I can attract for you to learn from. Thanks again for listening, and join me again soon here on The Unlock Moment.